From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners. That's you. We are very thankful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
To me, this separation of church and state is not really a radical idea. It's a very simple common sense principle. You don't want the church to be run by the state, and you also don't want the state to make the public policy decisions that run America.
The Reverend Barry Lynn is the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a position he's held since 1992. He's just published a new book titled God and Government, 25 Years of Fighting for Equality, Secularism, and Freedom of Conscience, which offers valuable lessons from this crucial struggle to preserve our very democracy. On this week's show, Barry Lynn will be back with us on State of Belief.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently.
January 2016 will mark 10 years of State of Belief Radio. That's still a long way off, but with almost 500 broadcasts under our belt already, it's not too early to start getting ready to mark the occasion. We'll do that in the coming months by digging deep into our archives to revisit particularly memorable conversations from the past decade. And on this week's show, you'll hear Pulitzer Prize winner John Meacham talking about his book, American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation, in an interview that originally aired in July of 2006.
A lone ultra-Orthodox man armed with a dagger stabbed indiscriminately into the crowd.
Two homes burnt in a devastating nighttime attack. An 18-month-old boy was killed.
A couple of extremist attacks in Israel have raised concerns around the world. Interfaith Alliance Executive Director Jack Moline will be here with some thoughts about this sad turn of events that saw deadly violence perpetrated upon participants in Jerusalem's recent gay pride parade, as well as on a Palestinian family in the West Bank. But first,
people who have seen the tanks and the tear gas around the world can now hear the stories of clergy who have been on the ground in a variety of ways.
August 9th is the one-year anniversary of the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. The police killing of the unarmed black teenager sparked national outrage and widespread violence. A catalyst of the still-growing Black Lives Matter movement, the event and its aftermath have been captured in a remarkable new book titled Ferguson in Faith, Sparking Leadership and Awakening Community. And I am very pleased to have the author, Dr. Leah Gunning Francis, joining me now. Leah, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You made the decision to tell this story in the words and voices of the people most directly affected, as well as the leaders and activists that responded in the aftermath of Ferguson. I'm curious, why did you take that approach?
You know, for me, it was important for people around the country and around the world to be able to hear and see a story that they were largely removed from and only had very often negative images about it. And so many around the world saw the images of tanks or tear gas, but many people have not heard the stories that are present in this book, the stories of hope, the stories of community, the stories of relationship building, the stories of leadership. And I really wanted people to have a firsthand account of those stories.
Were there one or two people that you spoke to that you would consider just essential for others to know and hear?
So one clergy person, she's the pastor of a Unitarian Universalist congregation in Chesterfield, Missouri. And Chesterfield is an affluent, predominantly white suburb of St. Louis. And many in her congregation, she felt, were largely removed from what was happening in Ferguson, didn't see it as something that related to them per se. And so she wanted to really connect the people in her congregation to the issues that were unfolding. And so what she did was have a family in her congregation give their personal testimony on a Sunday morning about how they have experienced racial discrimination in Chesterfield. And so one of the young women in the family is a teenage young girl who is from Cambodia and was adopted by a white family. And she talked about on a Sunday morning how she felt the pain of racial discrimination in Chesterfield. Every time she would walk into the pharmacy with her friends, you know, her white friends would never be asked to leave their bags at the desk, but she would always have to leave her bag at the desk. And just many instances of being made to feel less than and just feeling discriminated against. And then her mother, who is white, talking about her rage of not being able to protect her daughter and how unfair it was that she was targeted in this way solely because of the color of her skin. At the end of that testimony, people in the congregation were crying. They were saying, oh my gosh, we didn't know. You know, here was this family that they all knew and loved and didn't know they had these kind of experiences. But the pastor didn't want to leave it with just, oh, that's such a sad story. She took it the next step and said to the congregation, well, what is an appropriate response? And what they decided to do was to start holding a vigil outside of the Chesterfield Mall every Saturday for an hour. And during that time, they held up signs to awaken their neighbors right in Chesterfield to the reality that racism lives there too. Racial injustice lives there too. This is not just a Ferguson issue, but this is our issue too. You know, they went one more step further. In addition to standing in front of the mall, they noticed that there was a bus stop nearby, and they would see people getting off of the bus and walking to the mall to go to work. They'd have on their uniforms. And they noticed that the majority of these people were black. So they were coming from places in the city of St. Louis and around to come to work to Chesterfield Mall. But the problem was there was no safe passageway from this bus stop into the mall. There was no sidewalk. It's a very busy road from the bus stop into the mall. And so people found themselves kind of dodging traffic and bobbing and weaving to get to the mall. And so they're in the process of petitioning MoDOT and the city of Chesterfield to see what do we need to do to make it a safe passageway from this bus stop into the mall. You know, these are the tangible kinds of things that really help to build stronger communities. A second example is from one of the young activists that I interviewed. Her name is Brittany Farrell, and she talks so much about being a woman who knows about the church and who has been to church many times, but felt very disconnected from the church because so often people would say one thing and do another, didn't really make young people feel welcome inside the church. But after encountering these clergy in the streets and having these clergy come up to them, introduce themselves, talk to them just like regular people as opposed to talking at them or trying to talk over them, to be able to take the time to build those kinds of relationships really was very impactful for her. And she talks about in the book how, you know, the church came to them. and really became the hands and feet of Christ in ways that she had never seen before in her life. So those are just two of many stories that are in the book that I find so impactful and so relevant to us as people of faith, and especially those of us who are seeking to understand what it means to allow our faith to give expression in very intentional and active ways for the purpose of justice. Mm. In other words, how do faith and justice go together? And where do we find creative ways to get expression to that?
Well, those are great stories. What was your involvement on the ground in Ferguson, and what was it like participating in the protest, being there as a faith leader, but also as a mother?
From the day after Michael Brown was killed, I participated in a clergy vigil that was held at the police department. At that time, we didn't have a whole lot of information. We knew that people were angry, and rightfully so. What was becoming increasingly clear is that Michael Brown was unarmed. He did not have a weapon. But even though we didn't have the facts of what happened, whether he had a weapon or not, that at that moment, that wasn't what was paramount for us. What was paramount for us was there was a community in crisis. There was a young man that had tragically been killed, and we first wanted to pray. But we did not stop there and went on to pray with our feet. And so the way I prayed with my feet, along with others, I was immediately involved in planning meetings and protests. I walked the streets of West Florissant. I walked, you know, in other streets in protest. But I was also one of the co-organizers of the Mother's March, and a mother of two African-American sons who are beautiful and vibrant and thriving. And so my desire to help create a world where they can grow and live in a society and be free to move around and not be, you know, imposed upon because or made, you know, negative assumptions about because of the color of their skin. I take all that with me into this work. We put out a call for mothers to come and stand, to call for justice for Mike Brown, and call to an end against all violence against our children in our communities, because all of it is wrong.
The killing of Michael Brown certainly helped to galvanize a movement, but it's nothing short of heartbreaking that we've seen so many other stories of black deaths at the hands of law enforcement in the year since Ferguson. Have we made any progress as a nation?
We have not made the progress that we need to make. What we have done is started raising awareness where people are now unable to say, oh, these are just isolated incidences. This is if this one person had just, you know, not turned his back to the police officer. You know, those arguments cannot be made. There have been enough incidences where people have to question the role of race and racism in these killings. What has happened and what is a step toward progress is the fact that this is still very much a national conversation. And who I never imagined that I would live to see the Confederate flag in front of the South Carolina State House be officially removed, but it has been. And this is after years of people lobbying to make that happen. So the hope is that even though much progress has not been made, that the movement that has been galvanized and continues and the ways in which individuals and communities have been awakened to the realities of police brutality and racial injustice in the United States is putting us on a path toward change. We just need to keep pursuing it.
Dr. Leah Gunning Francis is Associate Dean for Contextual Education and Assistant Professor of Christian Education at Eden Theological Seminary in St. Louis. She's the author of the new book, Ferguson and Faith, Sparking Leadership and Awakening Community, published by Chalice Press. Leah, I really admire what you have been doing, what you will continue to do, and I appreciate so much you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
And I thank you so much for having me today. It was truly a pleasure to talk with you.
The Reverend Barry Lynn has been the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State since 1992. As pastor and an attorney, he is a passionate and effective advocate for the cornerstone of our constitutional democracy that Interfaith Alliance has defended for so many years. Somehow, he has managed to find the time to pen a memoir of his work titled God and Government, 25 Years of Fighting for Equality, Secularism, and Freedom of Conscience. And I'm happy that it brings the Reverend Barry Lynn back to State of Belief Radio. Barry, congratulations on the book and welcome back to State of Belief.
Well, Welton, it's nice to be back here, and it's really nice to be back here talking about a book which I thought for a while would never be finished.
25 years. That's a long time, Barry.
It is a long time, but, you know, you've been in one way or another doing the same thing. We've been looking at the same people with whom we have strong disagreements. I wouldn't call them enemies, but I would say that they are people who are enemies of the First Amendment as properly understood. They are people who don't seem to understand that religion is not supposed to be a weapon to be used against people literally or figuratively. And when you look back over 25 years, one of the things I do early in the book is to take a look at a speech I gave to the ACLU of Texas about 20 years ago, top 10 things that bother me about the religious right. And with a change in some of the examples, you could use the same 10 things today that still bother me.
Yeah.
So times change, but the religious right's fundamental disabilities do not.
Well said. What do you wish you had known 25 years ago that you know now in terms of effective activism and advocacy in the midst of the people you've just mentioned?
You know, I think one of the things is I would do something that Ronald Reagan once said, trust, but then verify. Because I do think that in some of the efforts to find common ground, to find collaboration, some of the folks on the religious right simply don't play fairly. In other words, when working on the Equal Access Act, which was an issue that I think became important after the defeat of the school prayer amendments, people were looking, well, what can students actually do to form groups and to talk about their faith? And, of course, originally it was promoted as a religious-only bill to pass the Congress. And I worked with some of these conservatives and said, look, if this is a student's free speech bill, if it guarantees students the right to hold non-curricular club activities, and it's across the board, the ACLU can probably support it. And I was with them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was worded. And then we find out later, of course, that as soon as the Gay Straight Student Alliances start to be formed, people who loved the Equal Access Act said, well, we didn't really mean gay kids could be involved with it. And I thought that was completely hypocritical. To their credit, there are a few people who were consistent about it, but a lot of people weren't. And similarly, with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we supported as well, nobody, absolutely no one, Ted Kennedy, President Clinton, nobody thought that this was going to apply to for-profit companies of any kind so that they could deny insurance coverage for contraception. Sadly, the 5-4 decision of last year's Hobby Lobby case at the United States Supreme Court. If there had been a suggestion that a for-profit company of any size, of any character, could discriminate in the coverage it was giving to its women employees, that whole fragile coalition of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act would have exploded take a watermelon and hit it with a shotgun, and that would have been exactly what would have happened.
Looking back and looking around now, is religious freedom better off or worse off today than it was when we got into all this?
Part of the reason I wrote this book was to say, look, when you hear some of the strange things that are coming out of the mouths of the so-called religious right, or even out of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, or even out of many of the presidential candidates, and you go, I can't believe people are saying this, it's 2015, we have to remember that there are some issues that we have essentially laid to rest, certainly in the courts. I mean, school prayer, it doesn't come up. I mean, recently Ted Cruz said we needed to amend the Constitution for school prayer. But pretty much this is an issue without legs. We have to be vigilant. You and I and many other people know that there are people on the religious right who are trying to curl around the edges of Supreme Court decisions that say no school prayer, no prayer that in any way is tied to the administration of a school. Similarly on evolution, I mean, after we and the ACLU and the Pepper Hamilton Law Firm did that case against intelligent design in Dover, Pennsylvania's biology department, it pretty much ended litigation over this issue, and notwithstanding some rumors about what's happening in your home state of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal obviously would love to have alternatives to evolution taught, but he has to be very reticent about it, and the ACLU of Louisiana and Americans United have agreed that in the event that we can find plaintiffs in any of those schools where they may try to sneak in pseudoscience into biology classes, pseudoscience is, which is really religious in nature, we would sue them.
Yeah.
The other thing that makes me feel good about the general direction, a kind of qualified optimism, is that millennials dramatically believe church-state matters differently than their parents or their grandparents did. So you find that 53% of millennials think that for-profit companies must provide free contraceptive insurance company. 64% are pro-marriage equality even before the decision in the Obergefell case. 68% of millennials support the evidence for evolution, 7% higher than any other age group in the country. So if evangelical millennials are more pro-choice, more pro-contraception, more pro-marriage equality than their parents, this is, in fact, a good trajectory for church-state separation and a bad trajectory for mixing conservative politics with conservative theology like their parents often did.
Hmm. My guest is the Reverend Barry Lynn, longtime executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. How do you now see the work that you've been doing, and does it look even more important to you than it did when you began? What do you find most satisfying about what you're doing?
I think what I like to do is to get up every morning and know not only that we are on the right side, that we understand theology and the law in the correct way, but that we can do something about it, that we have a fulcrum in which we can move people's attention and move their interest. And generations after generations, I think, are becoming more understanding that your religious rights to impose your religious beliefs on others is not the way the American experience ought to be lived. So at Americans United, as you know, we started a project a few months ago called Protect Thy Neighbor. The idea is you don't use religion as a way to harm other people. You don't say, wait a minute, we won't serve you at this bed and breakfast because you're a gay couple. That we want to make sure that religion is appreciated, but that it's appreciated as a shield against government power. It is not used as a sword against other human beings who live next door.
Barry, when you look at the array of items on your agenda, how do you decide, or have you decided, what are the biggest challenges right now?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem we have now is that certain things that seem to be and were seen as abnormal in the 40s and 50s are becoming shall we say, more acceptable to more people. Certain practices like funding religious ministries. I mean, if one can find a way, as this administration tries to do, to keep some kind of rules and regulations to prohibit the use of tax funds for the direct effort at evangelizing, nevertheless, I am very disappointed with the state of the faith-based organization in the Obama administration. I'm very concerned that even when Barack Obama, to his credit, issued an executive order over a year ago saying if you get a government contract or you get a government grant, you cannot discriminate in your hiring on the basis of sexual orientation. That's good. But now we have the irony, since he has failed to change an old executive order from the Bush administration, that you can't discriminate against someone who is a lesbian who wants to work at your federally funded facility, but you can say no Jews allowed. It's absurd in 2015, and a deep stain on the record, the civil rights record of this administration, that this kind of religious discrimination is still permitted in government grants and contracts. It should be changed, and my hope is that this president and the new attorney general will understand that this is a problem that needs to go away. Similarly, politics being promoted from the pulpit is one thing. Partisanship being promoted from the pulpit is something else. It is illegal under the tax code. The Obama administration has spent 4.5 years trying to figure out how to rewrite one sentence, in order to make it possible for the IRS to go after religious institutions and other charities that, frankly, break the law. They endorse candidates. And we're not talking about people on the fringes here. This is not if you mention something about, oh, elect pro-life candidates. We're talking about people who tell you exactly who to vote for. This happens in churches across the ideological spectrum, but to no surprise, mainly from right-of-center churches. This administration needs to change this rule. They've had rulemaking, and lots of us have filed comments about it. But it's very simple. You just need to change one sentence in the regulations affecting the Internal Revenue Service, and we could start to look at those instances, including ones where, for example, a pastor says on a Sunday, if you folks need a ride to the polling place on Tuesday, come by and the church bus will take you there. And then the church bus driver, when you get there on Tuesday, says, oh, who are you going to vote for? And if you happen to mention, in this specific case, a Democrat, they don't let you on the bus. I mean, this is well beyond any gray area that may exist in the law. So those two are the deepest disappointments with this administration. This is not rocket science. This is not transforming health care. This is not solving the Middle East. This is just rewriting one sentence. You know, there's that old story about if you put an infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters together, they will eventually type the works of Shakespeare. My sense is if you put, like, let's say five monkeys, five word processors together, and say, affix this one sentence, they'd have fixed it already, and they'd be halfway through Hamlet by now.
Oh, my. Barry, I've got to ask you, because of what happened this past week, 9 federal agencies proposed new regulations reforming rules for partnerships between government and faith-based groups. I have read this.
Yeah.
I don't see much change. Am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. And you and I were a part of this whole process of attempting to get the right movement here. There is some movement in the right direction, particularly in telling the beneficiaries of social programs that they do have alternatives, that they don't have to go along with a prayer session before they get a meal. All of this is in a good direction. But until you lock horns with the fundamental inappropriate decision not to resolve this hiring discrimination, acting like it's okay to say, Well, you know, we're more comfortable if we only hire Christians. And then that becomes the excuse for not hiring Muslims, Jews, atheists. Until you get over that, most of this is tinkering around the edges. It's important tinkering, and it's even in the right general direction. But it's a far cry. In this, the sixth year of the Obama administration, it took a heck of a long time to make a very few minor changes.
Yeah. The Reverend Barry Lynn is the Executive Director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. His new book is titled God and Government, 25 Years of Fighting for Equality, Secularism, and Freedom of Conscience, an Insider's Account. Barry, I am really glad that you wrote the book. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
All right. Thanks so much, Wilton.
Since he sat down with me for this interview back in 2006, John Meacham has authored books about Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, won a Pulitzer Prize, edited Al Gore and Joe Scarborough, among others, and today holds the title of executive editor and executive vice president at Random House. And you know what? He's still only 46. When John Meacham joined me in the studio in July of 2006, our focus was his just-published book, American Gospel. You see in the thoughts of the founders of this nation the prescription for sustaining a diverse nation without sacrificing faith or freedom. Did you begin with this conviction, or did you come to that conviction as you worked on this material?
I came to the conviction, and I was hoping that I would find what I found. I wanted to do the road to the religion clauses of the First Amendment, and then I found a much richer story, I think, which was the whole battle over religious freedom, both in the states and in the federal workings, and emerged with what I called the American Gospel, which I believe that the great good news about the country is that faith shapes us without strangling us or controlling us.
After looking at the primary documents and the founders of the nation closely, what is the most important myth regarding the founders and the founding? And I'm really, I guess, looking for a myth which, if confronted by the truth, would benefit the nation.
That's a great question. I think the idea that we were founded as a Christian nation is the most persistent myth, because I think many people on the religious right believe that we were founded as a Christian nation, that we have fallen from those pure origins, and that the point of political action is to get back to that Edenic state. If we could recover the spirit and sense of the Christian founding of the country, then would our moral life be more coherent? Things would be well. It's an appealing myth, and like many myths, it's full of holes. Historically, there is quite the opposite of there being evidence for this being a Christian nation. There's evidence to the contrary. George Washington, in 1790, in his first 4 years president, wrote a letter to the Hebrew congregation at Newport, Rhode Island, saying that the government of the United States shall give to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. And then, borrowing an image from Micah, he said, Every man should sit under his vine and fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. We passed a treaty in 1797 with the Muslim nation of Tripoli, in which we said that the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. The only mention of religion in the Constitution is to ban test oaths, so that your civil rights were not part of any religious profession of belief. Theologically, as you know, you can't have a Christian nation. Just using the Christian scriptures, Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, then would my servants fight." And so I think that is the Christian nation myth is the most persistent. I think if we can talk to people who believe that on both historical and theological grounds and convince them that it's not the case, then I think to some extent this the volume could come down a bit.
You conclude in your book, a stirring observation, I think, that preserving American freedom is the most demanding of tasks, requires unrelenting work and a resilient spirit. I'm interested in, if you're doing that work, what are the top two or three items on your agenda?
Religious liberty is often called our first liberties, the first liberty in the First Amendment. And it's not just about what you do on Sunday morning, or it's not about somebody frog marching you down to a certain church. It's about liberty of thought. It's about how you think. It's about democracy. It's about how we can live and work together without coercion. And so I think the first thing to do is to ensure religious liberty, ensure freedom of conscience, make sure that church and state stay separate, but to respect that religion and politics can't be separated. And so, you know, if you're watching Meet the Press, if you're watching C-SPAN, if you're listening and you're following a debate and a person says, well, we have to do X for a religious reason, don't go crazy. Don't pound the person. Don't think, oh my God, that's some crazy Christer. It may be. That person may be all those things. But they have a right to make this case. And you have a right to make the opposite case on whatever grounds you want. And the point of America, the point of the Republican system, lowercase r, as laid out in Federalist 10, is that all of us will go into the arena, we will let the contending forces bump up against each other, and through a system of checks and balances, we'll reach some temporary solution to something that'll get us through one storm until the next storm comes. Democracy is a completely unfinished work.
John, could the First Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees us religious freedom, be passed today?
Oh, that's a great question. I think so, and here's why. I think that enough religious people understand, at least I hope they do, or they would in the course of that debate, that Ronald Reagan was right. The moment you deregulate something, it grows. And the moment we disestablished churches in the United States, religion took off. The Second Great Awakening, the great fervor of American religious spirit happened once the government got out of the business of churches. The reason Jefferson was so big on this is he was upset that Quakers were stripped of the rights of custody of children if they didn't have their children baptized in the Episcopal Church. Madison heard the cries of Baptist missionaries and ministers being tortured in Orange County, Virginia. So this was real to them. This was something that wasn't an abstraction. They had seen it. I think that enough people, I would hope, enough clergy, enough religiously active people would see that the free exercise clause is hugely important, obviously, and something we have to cherish, but that the establishment clause is good for the church and good for the state. Roger Williams used to talk about how we had to keep the garden of the church safe from the wilderness of the world.
Do you have counsel regarding the wisdom of amending the Constitution now, whether we're talking about the Flag Protection Amendment or defining marriage?
I'm a big believer that the reason they made it so hard to do is that we should do it very rarely. And I particularly think so in terms of the Madisonian construct of the checks and balances we have. Now, you hear a lot on the right about unaccountable, unelected judges. Well, you didn't hear a whole lot about that until the Republicans had both control of the White House and the Congress, and they realized that they still weren't getting exactly what they wanted, so they had to find somebody to talk about, and the judiciary moved into that vacuum. But you can't – it's sort of like if you're a secularist and you want to only read the Constitution and say, well, it doesn't mention God, so we're a secular country. Or if you're a religious person, you can't only just read the Declaration of Independence and say, well, it talks about nature's God and the Creator. You have to read them both together. If you're going to buy into the whole experiment, which we should do because it's the most enduring such arrangement in human affairs, you have to buy it whole. So you have checks and balances. We have a judiciary to be a break on these things. And if something is so outrageous that enough people want to do it, then amend the Constitution.
John Meacham, you're a great educator and inspirer, author of American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. John Meacham, thank you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having me.
Still very relevant today, the 2006 interview with Pulitzer Prize winner John Meacham focused on his book, American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. With the show's 10th anniversary coming in January of 2016, we look forward to revisiting other favorite interviews in the weeks and months ahead. Now, before we go, in the past couple of weeks, we've been saddened by several tragic stories of extremist violence in Israel. The stabbing attack on participants in Jerusalem's gay pride celebration by an ultra-conservative Jewish man that left a 16-year-old girl dead. The arson attack on a West Bank Palestinian home that killed an 18-month-old boy. We've invited Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance, to share some thoughts on these tragic events.
Thanks, Welton. Jewish theology does not give us the luxury of a devil. The violence that any person commits comes from within, not from without. I therefore have to admit to a certain discomfort on my part when I hear people attempt to externalize the evil and brutality in this world by blaming it on others or on circumstances beyond our control. If I thought I were up against some supernatural power, I wouldn't really bother with trying to fix what needs repair. A friend reminded me of this important notion by directing my attention to Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. It appears daily, slightly amended, in Jewish evening worship. God brings forth light and creates dark, makes peace and creates evil. The verse appears in the context of Isaiah's affirmation that the world, including the world of politics, exists as a whole and not as competition among supernatural equals. When I witness the evil of the world, the murder of a child in a fire set by terrorists, or the hate-driven attack on a gay pride parade, I must recognize that I share something with the perpetrators of these horrors. We have a shared beginning and therefore a shared responsibility. We at Interfaith Alliance focus entirely on a domestic agenda. Our concern centers on the Constitution of the United States and the behavior of our government and our citizens. But the phenomenon of religious extremism is worldwide, and its conflict with the more inclusive instincts of a global community is instructive no matter the location. As a rabbi for more than 30 years, I can't help but be drawn to special attention to my own faith community. And so when I discover that in less than a week, two successful attempts at murder and one foiled attempt at desecration have been perpetrated by right-wing adherents of Jewish communities in Israel, I sit up and take notice. With a peculiar Abrahamic thoroughness, an ultra-Orthodox felon stabbed Jews in an LGBT pride parade, murdering a 16-year-old girl. Nationalist hooligans were apprehended just before attacking the Christian Church of the Multiplication. And price tag terrorists defaced and set fire to a Muslim home, incinerating an 18-month-old toddler. I cannot tell you if they were encouraged by their religious mentors, but I can tell you that they were not prohibited by them. I've heard from many corners of my community in the aftermath of these tragedies. Rabbis, communal leaders, and people in the street have mostly expressed a sense of devastation and mostly offered the expected repudiation. No one who truly follows our religious teachings would commit such an act, is what they say. Our struggle against the excesses and distractions of the modern world are internal and peaceful. And then others object. If you are so peaceable, then how do you explain these murders, those bombings, that vandalism? How did you allow these criminals to remain in your community? Why do you make contributions to the organizations that sustain them? You share a name, a heritage, a scripture. Why don't you share a responsibility? And those are critical challenges. the Jewish community in general, and Orthodox Jews in particular, and fundamentalist extremist Jews in specific, must take responsibility for condoning the language and environment that nurtured these terrorists. It is not enough to call someone, to turn a phrase, a lone wolf. It is not enough to claim that a perpetrator who identifies entirely as an Orthodox Jew is not fairly considered a product of that orthodoxy. The perpetrators of these crimes are indeed a tiny minority of believers, and not only among Jews, but among Christians, Muslims, and other religious extremists. But they do not exist in a vacuum. When religious leaders use religious language to denigrate, demonize, and dehumanize people who do not share their beliefs, they are accessories to the actions of those who consider their words to be sacred. The wise Dr. Eboo Patel was asked why Muslim leaders did not strongly enough condemn terrorism. With aplomb, he answered, "I condemn terrorism completely. Tell everyone you know." It is only when we take responsibility within our own communities for the excesses that validate the worst behaviors of the faithful that we have a hope of preventing future tragedies. And until we have done so, it is hypocritical to the highest degree to accuse others of the shortcomings that we refuse to address among ourselves. Tell everyone you know.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, good! I want to say thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping the show on the air. Look, if you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcasts and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories that you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help spread the word. Let's broaden this conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. It's crazy out there, friends. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.